You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
When it comes to race in America, it is a complex history of oppression and healing, discrimination and understanding. There has been a constant back and forth of setbacks and progress from the founding of our nation until the present day. And on societal and personal levels, engaging in conversations about race are both difficult and necessary. Theater can serve as a powerful platform for these discussions, offering a space for nuanced exploration of racial dynamics. Through storytelling, theater allows audiences to empathize with characters from diverse backgrounds, challenging preconceptions and fostering dialogue. It provides a visceral experience that can elicit strong emotions and provoke introspection. By showcasing a diverse range of perspectives, theater contributes to a more inclusive cultural landscape and promotes concern and compassion. My two guests today wrote such a play that was born from their own backgrounds, preconceptions, and even misunderstandings. They took on a difficult subject, yet were both open to see where it would take them.
Hi, I'm Carrie Sandell. I am a born and raised Floridian. There's not a lot of us, but we're out there. And I currently reside in Pensacola, Florida. And I am an actor and producer and playwright. Dissonance is my first play, and I've got one that is in the process of being written right now.
Hey there, I'm Marcy Duncan, and I am also born and raised in Florida, and I currently live in Spanish Fort, Alabama. It's right outside of Mobile, Alabama. And I am an actor, a playwright, director. I'm also a professor at the University of West Florida. And I coach with my business Artist at Play workshops as well. I teach actors and inspire actors and encourage them to pursue their dreams.
For the purposes of our conversation today, it's important to note that Carrie is white and Marcy is Black. Yet they not only share a common birthplace and are both mothers, but they each have a deep affection and appreciation for the performing arts. And they see the arts as a vital way to bring love and light to historically difficult and emotionally charged conversations.
We all have the ability to open up our phone and have more entertainment at our fingertips than we ever wanted. You know, so the world doesn't need more entertainment. We need connection, you know, and theater has a beautiful, magical way of doing that in ways that other media does not.
Welcome to another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, an award-winning theater podcast. I'm Patrick Oliver Jones, a New York actor and singer, and each week I talk with fellow artists about personal setbacks and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can donate, subscribe, and find past episodes. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Well, Carrie and Marcy, it is such a pleasure to meet you both, and I am so grateful that you're both here on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, both of you come from my neck of the woods, both in Alabama and Florida. I was born in Alabama. I spent 9 years in Central Florida. And so that's been home for both of you.
Absolutely. Born and raised in Florida, and I've been in Alabama for about maybe close to 8 years now.
And I was born in Florida, grew up in Central Florida, so I'm probably familiar with all the areas you live. And right. I've been in the Panhandle in Pensacola for about 10 years now.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, Florida is one of those places where people don't think of it as a theater state, but there's so many theaters around there. Like Oslo does a lot of new works, and there's those in Central Florida and on the coast. There's a thriving theater community there where you can create new works.
That is so true. You know, one of the things that I love is that wherever I lived at in Florida and now Alabama, I am able to stay busy. I'm able to find work and, as we'll talk about today, create work. So I honestly realized how big the opportunity here is in the state of Florida and how many like professional theater companies that pay, you know, for you to come and do your work, whether that be directing or acting. I think it's cool.
Yeah. And I think Florida gets a bad rap when it comes to the arts and other things. You know, I mean, you open up any news channel and you hear Florida Man and then some ridiculous story. But we do have some great opportunities. We've got, you know, Orlando and Tampa and South Florida. And, you know, you do have bigger cities. But I think, you know, one of the things that people don't think about is the snowbird community. All the people that come here for the winter, you know, they're interested in being engaged in theater and experiencing something. And a lot of them come from the Northeast, where theater is a very active part of their regular life. So that, I think, feeds in also to, at least in our area, I know we have a theater that is very well supported by those that just live here part of the year.
Yeah. That's definitely, there's a lot of retirees that come there, as you say, the snowbirds. And so they're people who are used to theater where they are from, a lot of them from New York. And so they come down to Florida and they want to see the same thing. So yeah, that makes total sense. Well, as we get started here, we'll begin with story number one. And for you, Marcy, when you began as an artist and teacher of the arts, you felt that you had to dumb yourself down, kind of pull back on your capabilities to make others feel less intimidated of you. You say that you were often told, quote, you're intimidating. Now, did they ever give you a reason for why these people felt that way?
You know, I think it was primarily is because I walk around in my skin very confident. Now, as I have matured and, you know, walked through life, I realized, you know, where that sense of confidence comes from. And it's because I wanted to make sure that I was doing my best, that I was representing myself and my family in the best way that I possibly could. Because, you know, in my culture, in my family, it's often said you have to be the best. You have to be one or two steps ahead of them. You can't just be okay. You have to be great. And so walking around with that type of awareness, when I walked into a room, I had a sense of confidence because I was prepared. I had studied. I had, you know, made sure that I was ready for the moment. And oftentimes when you walk into the room with that confidence and that amount of readiness and desire and passion, people are uncomfortable as to what to do with that, especially when it comes out of a Black woman's mouth, you know, if it's a little bit louder or if we are taking up space in the room or if we are sure on what we want to do and what we want, that can seem to be a little intimidating from people. And for a while, you know, I started to say, well, am I intimidating? Am I that way? So I didn't really know how, you know, to quite think about that. So I started being the happiest person in the room, being the most cheerful person in the room, being polite and graceful and kind, making sure that they saw that I was nice. I was palatable, you know, and I was also smart and I was also talented and happy about that. So it was a kind of, and oftentimes they would tell me that, you know, wow, you're such a cool person. I was so intimidated by you when I first met you. And I'm like, okay.
So did that shift of being nice and being polite and, you know, being the nice one, good one in the room, did that help at all? Did that
nope.
smooth in any bridge? No?
It really didn't. Because I think that they interpreted that as not genuine. And honestly, you know, it was a little disingenuous and people were able to kind of experience that and go, I don't really know about this person. But I think I went to an HBCU, a historically Black college and university in Tallahassee, Florida, FAMU. And one of the things that I was able to do was to gain a really good sense of self, you know, where I come from, who I am as a Black woman. Being more comfortable, you know, in my skin and what I offer into a room. And I think that's the thing that helped me to carry it through life and also be okay with who I was. Now, it was a whole different ball game when I started writing this play, because we went a little bit deeper into that discussion. But I think that is where I started to really be okay with what I brought into a room.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you, after a lot of work with your therapist, that's when you started to really learn about yourself, learn that you were enough just as you are. I'm in therapy myself now, just to kind of rediscover, dig deep into those things. And it can be uncomfortable sometimes to see what's there.
It really can. And I'm going to tell you, the first thing my therapist said to me, and it blew my mind, because they can see things that we don't necessarily see. And we walk around with ourselves, so we're not truly aware.
And I'm tired of myself sometimes.
Okay, so tired. And she said to me, she said, what if you are the direct descendant of an African queen? Would you be talking to your queenly self like that? If you knew that you were a direct descendant of a queen, would you say those things to a queen? Would you think those thoughts about a queen? Would you apologize for your queenness? And she sent me home with that thought. And she said, I want you to really think about that. I really want that to sink in. What if you are? How would you then move through the world? You would move through the world with a different awareness, an unapologetic awareness, right? And so she challenged me to start to treat myself as if I were royalty, because who's to say I'm not?
I think that that's important for all of us to realize we are more than ourselves, because we see, as you said, we know ourselves 24/7. We know everything we do wrong. And we often need those people outside of us to remind us of what we do right, of what our strengths are, our capabilities, and to not shy away from them.
That's right. And I'm grateful.
I bet. And as you were mentioning, it made me think, because I grew up in the church, a Presbyterian church, and there's a certain way. It was a white Presbyterian church, but then I attended, when I was in college, a Black church. And I was like, this is very different. And so I think there is just a cultural way of, well, this is how I perceive religion or whatever the subject is. This is how I perceive it. This is how I act around it. And then I went to a Black church and there was a different way of receiving it, of acting around it. And I think that that can carry on into how we communicate and interact with each other. And a lot of times they're not on the same page, so to speak.
Absolutely. And I think it's important. I think it's important to reckon with the things that you think about, especially in terms of, you know, thinking and judging other people, you know, because sometimes those judgments and those thoughts, they come without our permission. And it's okay. It's okay. We think them. We question them. We doubt them. We investigate them. And then we leave space for the difference, right? We leave space for the difference because the difference is absolutely okay and acceptable. It's just when we attach a judgment to the difference and we attach a stereotype to the judgment is when we start to get into problems. And I have to constantly work. I teach college kids, and the longer I live, the further and further I get from their generation, right? Every year I come back, I'm further and further away from that generation. And so I find myself having to constantly think about the things that I think about them, about a different generation, investigate that thing, and then let it go and celebrate the differences that we have between us.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah, it really is a matter of recognizing the differences, but celebrating them as well. And then that's really what we have to do. And for you, Carrie, your theater career didn't begin with, moving to the bright lights of the big city, auditioning after college. You'd done some acting, but really your decision to start a family, just as you and your husband came together, and then he joined the Air Force as a JAG. So instead of enjoying that initial freedom and flexibility that a lot of actors get in their first several years of working, you really had to find balance between work life and home life. But the desire was still there, or did you think that maybe I'm just going to put this aside for now?
You know, I really thought, okay, I made a deliberate choice, and I think that that's important is, when we're, instead of being swept along with, I'm supposed to do this next, what is right for me right now? And then being at peace with that decision. And so for me, I knew, this would be something I revisit. But for me, for that season of my life, for, knowing we were going to be moving every few years and he was going to be a JAG in the Air Force and I was starting a family, I made that decision deliberately. And so the idea of going off and auditioning and moving or traveling a lot just did not fit into that paradigm for me at that time. But it wasn't a closed door. And I think, we have this Roman numeral outline of how our life is supposed to be. And, you graduate from college and then you move to New York or to Chicago or Atlanta or whatever, and you do your career and you hit the ground and you're auditioning like crazy and you're a barista or whatever while you're doing it. And, it doesn't have to look like that. Everybody's acting career doesn't have to follow the same path. I know some people that have had very vibrant careers never moving to a big city and working consistently from a regional theater to a regional theater and have built the reputation and have had a glorious, beautiful career without doing the thing that everybody thinks you got to do. And for me, it was the right decision, but when I re-entered into this world much older, there were some setbacks and I was, getting back on the saddle, but at the same time, the life experience that I've been able to now bring into roles and bring into my understanding of a script or a situation, you can't pay for that. So it was a good decision for me. And it was, I don't regret it. It just looks different than maybe I would have initially thought it was going to look.
And so now as a mother, how do you strategically plan the auditioning, the shows that you would do away from home or close to home? How do you balance that now?
I'm blessed. My husband is a rock star. And my kids are at the age now where, they don't need me around all the time. They're much more autonomous. And then they're also a part of it. Just like Marcy, our kids have come to shows and set up things in the foyer and helped us put the set up and help us load in and load out. And so they're a part of it and they're a part of this vision and what we're doing. And then, if it's a matter of I'm going to be gone for a few weeks, putting on a show and then I'll be back, then that's what it is. When I went back to college, my two youngest were murdered every night in Medea with me. I put my two kids every night in Medea. So they have been a part of the theater world. They understand it. They speak the language. So it's not a foreign thing to them, but you just show by show or season by season, you figure out what's going to work. You know, when you engage in becoming a part of a family, you're not the only one. So you do have to have those conversations and figure out what's going to work for us this season. And, you know, having the support of your partner makes all the difference in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you couldn't do what you do without your family being there. Absolutely. Mm-mm. And as you pick and choose and as you see, you know, the things you can and can't do as an actress, do disappointments ever set in when I wish I could be a part of that, but I can't do this. I'm over here. How do you handle that?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know. I guess I've just reconciled that I can't do all the things. And I'm not healthy and happy if I try to do all the things. And so instead of dwelling on the fear of missing out, really trying to be mindful of what my decision process is and why, you know, and a big part of that for me is, you know, for right now, dissonance takes such a priority. It's such a labor of love and a beautiful thing that's taking a life of its own, that that's for me now taking a priority over other things that I might take a look at. So that's a piece of the analysis as well.
And for the both of you, it seems like you'd mentioned this, Carrie, that your life experiences as a mother, you know, as we get older, we learn different things. We have different experiences. They've given you a lot of insight and depth into the characters and the scripts that you want to take on and perform in. Would that be fair to say that you're just a different actress, a different artist now than you were when you started?
Oh, 100%. 100%. You know, and everybody talks about, you always see actors talk about, oh, you know, as they're getting older, there's no roles and stuff. Well, in theater, it's the opposite. Like, this is the golden age for women in theater. You've got, think about every great, strong woman. They're not the ingenue, you know? And so I am not the same person because life brings you, you know, experiences as a parent or illness, death. I mean, we wrestle with some horrible things as we go through and grow and become new people in our life. But those are all ways in which, as storytellers and actors, you can tap into the greater human experience and have a deeper understanding than when you're young and you're just trying to imagine what is this like without having lived through the, you know, taking care of dying parents or having lived through the things that come along in our lives.
And for you, Marcy, how has your transition as you've grown into the woman you are now, how have you seen that transition as an actress as well?
You know, when I first started out, especially being theater trained, you just feel like there isn't a role you can't play, right? I can play any role because I've been theatrically trained, my dear. But as I get older, I realize that the effort that it takes to be away from my family, to prepare and to put all of the energy into doing my best work, I am interested in telling stories that speak to me. Whereas when I first started out, I would do anything. I would take any role. I was always saying yes. I was wearing myself out. Let's be honest, I still wear myself out. But now I know that the work that I do, it edifies, it gives back to me. And when I'm up there and I'm doing the work, I feel good about it. I feel like it's a good fit. I'm passionate about it. And that's not something that I could have said in my younger years. You know, I just said yes because I thought that's what actors were supposed to do. They were supposed to take the roles that were offered to them. Now I have, I'm careful and I'm selective because I can be and because I have a family. And I make sure that when I invest my time into the passion, it gives back to me and it doesn't take away from me because I already sacrificed things to do my work.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As we get into story number two, we'll talk about the motivations for being an artist and what keeps you both going. For you, Marcy, it was wanting your son to see you pursuing your dreams so that he knew that he could do the same as he got older. You would press on, you would hustle as an actress, and he was really the reason that you didn't give up. Would you say that being an actress made you a better mom in certain ways?
I would say that they both gave to one another, for sure. They both gave to one another. You know, when I first, I was in college and I was finishing up my last year in college and I found out I was pregnant and I immediately said, okay, I need to support this child. So I need to go to grad school because I know I want to act, but I also want to be able to support my son. So I went to grad school and I took him with me. And I like to say we went to grad school together, but nobody ever knew I had a child. So I took him and I wanted him to see me doing the thing because I wanted him to be able to say, no matter what situation I'm faced with, I can pursue my dreams. That was important to me. I don't know why. It was so important to me. I guess it was because the fear that I wouldn't be able to pursue my dreams because I had a child, because I was a single mom. I would have to abandon that and go to a 9-to-5 and do this other thing. So I guess I was trying to prove to myself that I could still reach my goals while at the same time, I felt that I was giving him a gift of seeing your mom pursue her dreams. And when my son said to me, I'm proud of you. You know, I'm not going to harp on that too much because you know I will be a ball of tears, but that hit differently. That meant something to me. And all of the things I got wrong, I know that I got right. And yeah. So he has always been the reason why I pursue. And now I have another son. And so I want him now to see his mom pursuing her goals and going after what she wants.
Have you seen evidence in either of your sons or both of them that they've learned from your persistence?
Oh my Lord, yes. Yes. So my oldest son, he is such a beautiful child and honestly he should be an actor, but he chose social work, which he's taking care of people, and that is so in line with his personality. And he went to school for it, and he persevered when he wanted to quit, and he kept at it. And now he's working in his field and you know, becoming his own man. And he is, you know, making plans and reaching for the things that he desires. And it makes me so excited. It makes me so excited that he doesn't need me to cheerlead him. He is able to kind of set off on his own path and pursue the things that he wants to pursue. And my youngest one, I have no doubt that child will be an actor because he is the most dramatic thing in this household, including me. And he is quite persistent. So mission accomplished.
There you go. There you go. Stamp it. Done. All right.
It's so funny because her youngest is a little guy. He's 4. So there's a huge age difference between them. And we were just saying we were in a show in Mississippi. And I was, Jackson, you know, you're probably the only kid at preschool that's ever done a load in or a load out. You're probably the only one that's ever helped set a setup.
I love it. I love it. Well, our motivations can certainly come from joyful things like having children and watching your sons grow up. But for you, Carrie, the, you know, loss can also be a motivator. And you lost a young colleague to suicide several years ago. She died actually the night before tech rehearsals were to begin in a university production of A Christmas Carol. And you say that losing her made you keenly sensitive to the needs for difficult conversations, for kindness in an industry that can sometimes be unkind. How has that loss really impacted you as both a writer and an actress?
That was really actually pretty significant. I wrote a chapter for a textbook companion about that and how it relates to communication. And so I've given this a lot of thought. And for me, there's a few things. You know, it kind of goes back to what Marcy was saying of, you know, if I want to create art and I want to spend time doing something, I want it to be edifying. I want it to be of value. You know, and to me, that means being edifying to someone else, or like with dissonance, you know, having difficult conversations, whether it be about race, whether it be about mental illness or addiction or, you know, any of these other things that touch so many of our lives that sometimes just don't get discussed. That is what my passion is as a storyteller, as an actor. I want my time and my creativity to be invested in giving life. You know, we all have the ability to open up our phone and have more entertainment at our fingertips than we ever wanted. You know, so the world doesn't need more entertainment. We need connection, you know, and theater has a beautiful, magical way of doing that in ways that other media does not. So I think we have, as theater artists, we have a fantastic opportunity to connect with one another, to have those conversations that can bring healing or understanding or empathy, compassion, or change. So for me, you know, thinking about this lovely, beautiful, incredibly, wildly talented young woman, and not knowing that she was hurting, that, you know, all of us were completely blindsided by this incident and by her death. And, you know, as far as most of us were concerned, she was the light in the room. She brought light with her. And, you know, we didn't know that there was hurt and there were things going on, you know. So for me, difficult conversations and things that bring hope are so, so important.
Yeah. You say that you wrote about it. I assume through that was a bit of taking on that grief and managing, navigating your way through it.
It was. And I, you know, I interviewed a lot of people for it that had been around that situation. And for them, it was interesting because there was a group that felt like they couldn't talk about it. And each of them articulated, not knowing what the other people had said, that it was, they had not moved forward in their grieving process. And it became a huge stumbling block to them emotionally. And I would imagine they were all actors, as performers, you know, when we are so like bent, you know, tightly bound up with our emotions, you can't access what we need to access emotionally. And those that felt like they had the freedom to talk about it, to bring light to the thing that was dark, the you know, to talk about the elephant in the room and explore it, allowed them that freedom to, you know, hey, let's acknowledge this. It's not, you know, just sweep it under the carpet and talk about, you know, act like it didn't happen. But it allowed them to heal so much faster. You know, and I think about her a lot. You know, I think about her a lot when I'm going on stage or preparing for a show, because she was just lovely. And it's just a reminder that, you know, I want to do important things.
Well, it also goes back to something Marcy said. It's like your judgment, your stereotype, whatever you think another person is or is going through, it may be wrong. You know, what we give to people isn't often what's going on the inside. And that's true of all of us. And it certainly is very true, because the very nature of theater is, you know, it's about building community. It's about building connection. You know, we have those close friendships when we're doing a play. We are connecting with an audience as well. But even in that intimate space of rehearsing and doing the show, you know, there can be fellow actors that we don't really know their lives. We don't know what's going on beyond that rehearsal room. And so I think it really takes a confident vulnerability to be able to share it, and as well as welcoming compassion to receive it. And I can certainly admit to not having both of those from time to time. So it's both a skill, yes, but it's also just a matter of being there sometimes, just a ready to listen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, in theater, we pride ourselves so much on our tribe, that we're so connected and close, you know, and for something like that to happen makes you realize exactly what you're saying, is people can have a whole life or world going on in their head and their heart that we don't know about. So kindness goes a long way.
The three stories shared in this episode are only part of the conversation. Subscribers get early access to the full interviews with guests, not only including these stories, but audition stories as well. Join Why I'll Never Make It and help support this podcast, as well as learn more about the guests and the lessons they've learned. Go to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or find the link in the show notes. And another benefit of being a subscriber, you won't have to listen to any ads either.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, as we get into story number three, we're going to talk about this play you've been mentioning, Dissonance. And you describe it as a two-person drama that asks the question, can a Black woman and a white woman who have been friends for 20 years have an open, honest conversation about race and have their friendship survive? And then for about 90 minutes, the audience follows your characters as they open up a cafe in a historically Black neighborhood. And in doing so, it uncovers some deeply held perceptions about race. And the two of you have to decide if being brutally honest and devastatingly vulnerable is worth risking the friendship. Now, certainly one of the biggest ingredients in any show is conflict. And I would say race is probably one of the most contentious topics to tackle, for sure, whether it's on stage or in real life. What brought the two of you to want to wade into these waters?
Well, thank you for asking. It was during the George Floyd climate, and it was very tense. It was a very tense time. We were also going through COVID. So we were kind of trying to figure it out at the time, you know, and there was a lot happening, and the temperature was very, very sensitive at the time. And so I was doing a show at Emerald Coast Theater Company in Destin, Florida, and Carrie came to see the show that I was doing. And after the show, she asked if she could talk to me. And I said, sure. And she asked me how I was doing. And I knew exactly what she meant. And she said, you know, I've been thinking about you a lot. And I've been thinking about the things that you are talking to your son about versus the things that I'm talking to my son about, because we both have sons around the same age. And she says, she said to me, and I think we should write a play about it. And I was very struck by that. I was very struck, and I was touched. We shed some tears in that moment. And we talked for a few seconds, a few moments. And then after we left that night, I just immediately started writing. I was so inspired by Carrie's action. And I did not know that I had a story that wanted to come out. And it took Carrie's action, her incredibly brave action, and initiating this conversation that really ignited the story coming forth. And we did. We got together on Zoom, and we had a long, long, long Google Doc where we asked each other questions. We had the conversation so that we could figure out what our story would be together. And it was it ended up being a wonderful platform for our conversation. And that conversation gave way to very authentic dialogue in our play.
I imagine a lot of that Google Doc found its way into the script.
It absolutely did. It absolutely did. And a lot of people, when they see our show, they're like, are those lines? Did you guys memorize that? Because it just sounds so natural. And it's because it came out of some of it came from real conversation. And we asked each other, you know, the questions and figured out each other's perspective. And it kind of blossomed from there.
It did.
And for you, Carrie, I'm so curious what made you reach out to Marcy in particular, but what made you, because both of you hadn't written a play before, so this was going to be a first time. What made you want to take that route and explore this very contentious topic?
I don't think we set out, either of us, going, we're going to write a race play and let's see what happens. But as women, as, you know, mothers, and people that were just experiencing the insanity of 2020, you know, I was genuinely thinking about Marcy a lot. Her son was 19 or 20 at the time. My son was 19 or 20 at the time. And so, you know, I as a mom was thinking about her. You know, what is she saying to her son when he gets in the car and he gets on the highway? She's saying different things than I'm saying to my son. I'm telling him, be careful, don't text and drive. That's not what she's telling him. I mean, she's probably telling him that, but she's telling him other stuff too that I don't have to think about. So the question was not, you know, hey, let's you and I figure out how to have this conversation and change the world. It was simply, how are you? You know, the love of one mother to another mother. So that was, you know, that was kind of the motivator. But thinking of it in terms of, I think we should have a conversation and I think this conversation should be a play, to me, it just kind of seemed natural, even though we had not written a play. You know, we're actors. We're storytellers. We see the world in stories. We make sense of the world in stories. You know, narratives are how we think. And so so that was really what started it. And Marcy's right. We had the world's longest Google Doc, but it was a really neat experience because it ended up creating this safe container where, you know, we had the separation of Zoom and we had the Google Doc where we could ask very intimate, intrusive questions and have a minute to think and really search our hearts of what do I think about that? What is my opinion? Or how do I want to answer this in a way that I can help her understand what it's really like? So it became this lovely, lovely way to create the skeleton of a play, because we did have these conversations that come out in the play. We did talk about, like Marcy talked about, being her authentic self and having to wrestle with that. We talked about situations in the career world where she's experienced things differently as a Black woman than I do as a white woman. We talked about culture and what that means for each of our experiences and appreciating and understanding culture. We talked about interracial debt, you know, all of these things that sometimes, you know, when you're having this conversation with someone of your same race, you can say these things without filtering or without censoring. And because we agreed, we're going to start this project together and our goal is unity. We're approaching it from a place of love. Let's be quick to forgive, and you know, just when one of us offends the other or says something stupid, remember why we're doing this and that we love each other. And so it made it a safe place. So it really was a fantastic experience as far as helping us get as honest as we thought we could until we got on our feet and started workshopping it and then realized, oh, we're still tiptoeing around things and we're still censoring ourselves. So it was a process, but such a big part of it was in that writing process.
You're so right. Our own tribe, whether it's race or religion or political affiliation, you know, whatever our tribe is, there are certain things you can just say, and there's an underlying foundation of, well, the givens, the understandings that are already there, and you can just kind of talk above that. But when you're on completely different life experiences, different pages, then you kind of have to give the foundation first, then talk about what you think about it. And so, yeah, you're right. You have to explain a little bit more. And it sounds like, as you said, this Google Doc gave you both the chance to, okay, well, here's where I come from. This is what this means. And this is how I think about it. And I'm curious, what would be one of the more surprising answers that either of you gave to the other? Like for you, Marcy, as you posed some questions to Carrie, what was one of the surprising answers that stood out to you?
Well, I think more so than a question that I posed to Carrie was a question that I said a term. I said the term reading the room. And Carrie commented back, what is reading the room? And I just assumed that everybody knew what reading the room was. And so I explained to her what that was. And then she pushed back with, why do you have to do that? Like, what, you know, why do you have to read a room when you go into a room? And so really having to sit and think about how to explain what it feels like to walk into a room and immediately feel you are not welcome. You are not welcome. And so I had to sit with that for a couple days to try to figure out a way to explain my experience and to help Carrie understand what that is, because not every room that I go into is a safe room. Not every space is my space. Not every environment is welcoming. And I have to take stock of where I am and who is there, and if this is the space that is inviting, or if this is a space that I'm going to have to shrink myself in. And that happens 24/7. That happens 24/7. And so I think that was one of the most interesting moments in our conversation when we were in the writing phase, is explaining that idea of reading the room.
And how about for you, Carrie? What was a surprising moment that happened for you?
There are a few things. For me, one of the things it did was it brought up something that I hadn't thought about in 152 years. I asked her, I said, well, what is your first experience of an awareness of race? And it made me think of what mine was. And I was born in Florida. We lived in Colorado. And I moved back to Central Florida long enough ago. I don't need to tell you the date, but long enough ago that for me, coming from out west to Central Florida, there was a huge cultural difference. And it never occurred to me as a kid. I was like fourth grade. And there were some sweet girls in the class that kind of showed me around as a new girl. And they let me sit with them at lunch at the cafeteria. And I became friends with them. And a little while later, there were some other girls in my class that came up to me and said, you know, if you keep hanging out with them, you're never going to have any friends. And it never, like, I didn't see it coming. And then it made me start to question, oh, well, they're Black. Is it because, like, am I doing something wrong? Because I immediately felt like, you're doing something wrong by being friends with them. You need to stop hanging out with them. And that was the first time where I had any kind of awareness of, oh, there's a difference in race. What, you know, I mean, I obviously they were Black, I was white, but there was no shame in that. There was no like discomfort in it until that thought was introduced to me. And I was told, you're not going to have any friends if you keep hanging out with them. So it made me revisit some of those things that, you know, I hadn't thought about in years and years and years and years. And it's like, how many people have their worldview so shaped externally by circumstances? So I thought about that and hadn't thought about it in years.
as we were asking each other questions. And then just as Marcy was explaining some of her situations or circumstances or worldviews based on what I was asking, we kind of touched on, and we go much more into it in the play, the idea of culture and how important it is. And for me, seeing it and not having that deep experiential ownership or almost like in my DNA what my culture is, because I'm just white American culture, right? And how beautiful it is to have that and to celebrate that and to recognize it in someone and to celebrate their culture. So for me, it was kind of a learning process as she was sharing answers to things that were foreign to me. The idea of culture really started to take a different shape for me.
And so as these conversations were happening, you, as you say, you started to see a play develop, you know, a script, so to speak, but then it came time to title it. Where did the term dissonance come from? Why did you choose that word?
I chose it because at its very, like when you hear it, everybody thinks of, you know, clashing, opposing forces, not in agreement or alignment. And I did that on purpose, of course, but it's also a musical term. And you can have musical notes that are dissonant, but they still create a beautiful sound, right? Jazz music is one of those genres that really does use that method in some of the jazz artists. So when I think about the musical term, I think about, you know, two different people coming together. And yes, they're different, and neither of them is trying to change the other, but they can still come together and create beautiful harmony together. And so that's where the title came from. Most people think it's about the fight, but it's more so about these two different sounding chords coming together still create some type of harmony together.
Yeah, it's interesting as you bring that up, because in those dissonant chords, those jazz chords, the crunchy chords we like to, that sounds so cool. But it's interesting that dissonance happens the closer notes get to each other. The notes that are just half a step from each other, they're the ones that cause the dissonance and cause that kind of different chord to take on. So it's interesting. It's the same, it seems like, the two of you. As you got closer together, there was both dissonance in disagreements or seeing things differently, but also in creating a new sound, a new chord, a new joining and connection with each other.
Right.
And it's so beautiful and perfect because these two women in the play have been close friends, the best of friends for 20 years, but they have avoided some of these things that would bring them together. They've tiptoed around the conversations that might be uncomfortable, or I don't really want to go there, it's too much work, or that's just, you know, the big old elephant in the room we continue to avoid. And as they begin to have this conversation, because they're opening this cafe and they're working and they are in it now, they have signed the lease, they have to have that conversation and get closer. And you see how much they love each other, but it does bring up some of these conflicts that they've been avoiding. And, you know, then they're creating something new.
Well, the final piece of any production is rehearsing it and doing it in front of an audience, you know, and you just wonder, will they get it? Will they enjoy it? Will it speak to them personally? Are these the questions that you ask yourself each time you go to a different venue and perform it?
Well, we've done it so many times now that I don't question what this piece is and what it sets out to do. And so I don't question that so much, but I'm going to tell you this. The first time that we performed it for an audience, I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. I did not know that I was terrified, but my body started to do things. And I was like, what is happening? We were in Tallahassee and we were in our rehearsal period and, you know, getting ready for the audience. and my neck and my shoulders and my back. I mean, I could barely lift my arm. It all started to lock up. And so I went to a chiropractor immediately and to a massage therapist. And that chiropractor was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? You literally look like you walk around, you know, with your shoulders at your ears all day. What is going on? And it wasn't until I was on that table, you know, when they put those patches on you to kind of do the electric shock massage. It wasn't until that I was on that table, and I had never wept in a chiropractor's office before, but I wept and wept and wept because I was finally silent and I was able to understand that my body was trying to protect me. My body was trying to protect me because being honest and being vulnerable and saying how you really feel, sometimes it doesn't pay off. Sometimes people misunderstand you. Sometimes people take things the wrong way. And furthermore, you're exposed. You're completely exposed and you have no idea how to protect yourself, right? And my body said, if you're not going to do it, crazy girl, I'm going to do it. So my body was trying to protect me from being vulnerable and being honest and truthful. And so I did. I had to work through that. I had to fight with my body to do it anyway. And once we got through opening night, I will tell you that that pain got less and less every day. And I haven't stopped seeing a chiropractor and a massage therapist to this day. But I just found it so interesting that the normal things that I do to keep myself safe from being vulnerable, it showed up here when I was trying to do my art. It really did. And it blew my mind because I wasn't expecting it. But I believe that I've overcome it because I think that vulnerability and authenticity is always the right way.
You know, when she says vulnerability, it wasn't just lines. You know, these were her words and her experiences. So it was bearing her soul in a way that was very public. So, but the thing that has been beautiful is we don't question, I don't think you do, we don't question how is this going to be received, because we've seen now, I mean, we knew we had something great. But then seeing it in front of an audience, you know, and their response, and we've had the privilege of performing it in very, very different demographics. The response, whether we're up north, on the East Coast, in the South, a predominantly Black audience, a predominantly white audience, an older audience, a younger audience, the response universally has been so overwhelmingly receptive. And we have had time and time again where people come and say, that's me and my friend. We had this conversation, or we have this friendship, or I want to have this conversation. I want to know how to do this. Or, you know, people want to have this conversation and they desire unity. And we talked about this when we were just starting this process. You know, everything in the media and the news between the murder of George Floyd and you know, which was the straw that broke the camel's back. There had been a series. And then the tension of being locked down, everything, we were living virtually on our phones or in the computer. And everything we saw was so politicized and so divisive. And we felt hopeless. I think just in general, the world was experiencing a lot of hopelessness. And as we've done this and we've taken this show across the panhandle of Florida, down into Central Florida, Ocala and Sanford and in D.C. and in New York, the reception is the opposite of the message we're getting. People want unity. People want to understand one another. And so it's just been so life-giving for us. You know, we don't question how it's going to be received. We do question, you know, how do we get people to see it? You know, how do we get our word out there? That's our question. But not, you know, if we can get people there, we know how it's going to be received. Every time we do a show, somebody in the audience says, everybody should see this show, you know? And we always say, yeah, we think so too. But, you know, the reception just universally has been the same. And when we were up in D.C. and in New York, we got the question both times from audience members. Yeah, but how do they receive it in the South? you know, I hate to disappoint, but it is well received. Mm-hmm. So it's very helpful for us.
I think too, if I may, one of the things about our play is the first thing you ever see is you see these two women love each other and you see their relationship and you see why they're friends. And then there is a point in the play where I'm not going to give it away, but something is revealed that then forces them to have a conversation. Now, the idea is okay, why is Angela, the character that I play, why is she avoiding the conversation? Why is Lauren, the character that Carrie plays, why is she avoiding the question? And what about this moment? What about this moment really makes them say, all right, let's do it?
It's funny. We had somebody come to our DC show, and he was like, I knew you were going to go there, but I didn't know you were going to go there. And it is that, you know, let's bare our souls. So it's cathartic, I think, for people.
Do you get like nervous laughter in some of the audiences where it's like, I don't know what to think about that. And I'm going to giggle, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yes, we do. And also, too, the play is funny. It is funny. So we do balance. We balance the material. Like I said, the first thing you see is you see these people loving each other and having a good time and dancing together and enjoying each other's company and working on this beautiful cafe together. And you also see them fight, but you also see them choose to dial in and have the conversation. And you see them take care of one another. But it is funny. And we have a lot of moments where the audience is rolling and laughing with us. Because, you know, another question that we get is like, goodness, is this play draining? Does it drain you all? And it's like, no, it gives. It gives. It is life affirming. It is an opportunity for me to do work that I love. And I'm proud. I'm proud of the work that we have created. And it gives me energy. It gives me life to tell this story. So it's not one that's taxing to tell, and it's really not one that's taxing to experience. You're gonna go on an emotional roller coaster, but it is not one of divisiveness. It is a story about friendship, love, and unity.
It's funny. In addition to nervous laughter, we get a lot of teeth sucking, a lot of We had, I'm thinking about a young man, early, you know, mid-20s probably in DC, who, you know, I try to always not look at the audience. I try to just kind of like blur it out, but he had this bright white hat on. And so we could see he was up on his haunches. He was standing in his chair, you know, kind of squatted down, and he kept grabbing his hat, And the whole time, we had such a visual of his emotional roller coaster. But we get nervous laughter, we get agreement, we get, oh no, you know, or where people are anticipating what's going to happen, and a lot of teeth sucking, a lot of
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly seems like that because both of you come with different life experiences, but also a love for the conversation, a love and care for each other, that it seems like the audience can then be a little, you know, certainly there's people on their haunches, you know, not sure what's coming up. But for the most part, the audience can kind of just rest and be like, okay, they're going to go there, but I will still feel seen. I'll still feel heard. It's not like I'm going to be preached at or dismissed for, you know, the audience wants to feel that too. They want to feel like they're being taken care of. And it sounds like that your play does that as well.
It absolutely does. There's no a villain in this play. Both of these women have opinions and have experiences that are both heard. Both sides are heard. And we made sure that this was an even-handed fight, that they both get an opportunity to fight, but we are not, this isn't a prescriptive play on how to have a conversation about race. It's these two women story and how they do it and how they come on the other side. So you're right. You're right. They're not, it's not a sermon. It's not a prescription. It's, you know, you are literally a fly on the wall in this cafe and you didn't know that you were going to hear this much.
And audiences are smart. They don't want to be condescended to. So, you know, when you're busy delivering a sermon or telling somebody how they're not right, nobody wants to hear that. But if you can have honest dialogue that shows honest perspectives, you know, they're experiencing that with you. So I think it's great. It makes me think of Marcy's nephew when he saw the show, how he communicated to you his impression of the show.
Yeah, he said, now he calls me his TT. He says, now, TT, I wanted to root for you the whole time, but she has some good points. I said, mission accomplished.
There you go. You're done. You did it. Yeah, very good. Very good. Thank you so much for joining Why I'll Never Make It. And don't forget, you can become a subscriber and get bonus conversations by going to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or just look for the link in the show notes. Well, that about does it for me. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and John Bartman. Be sure to join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.